Connecting the city and surrounding villages. You've found Cambridge 105.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Flavour, your food and drink programme for Cambridge, with me, Matt Bentman.
Me, Ruth Reyes.
And me, Alan Alder.
Thanks to Ian Dayborn for the last 2 hours. On Flavour today, some new and exciting food experiences with a feature on 3D food printing. Yes, printing food. And a visit to Alimentum, where Mark Poynton talks about some of the new dishes which are on the menu.
We hear about some new wines available at Noel Young Wine Merchants in Trumpington, the new pop-up allotment cafe at Novi.
And we've even got some new ideas for cooking cauliflower, and that's with Nazima Pathan of Frongley Kitchen. In addition, Dave Fox will be talking about what to do now that the new fruit and vegetable growing season is starting off.
And at the end of the show, we'll be having our usual roundup of Cambridge food and drink news. But first, printing food. Now, we hear about 3D printers being used to make items as diverse as components for machines, even human body parts. But did you know that you can now also print food? Dovetailed, a Cambridge company, has found a way to do this, and they do it using juices. Alan went along to their headquarters off Mill Road and spoke with Viva Kalinkita and Robert Curtis about how it all works.
How does it work? You extract the juice. I can't see how you get from the juice to a solid structure.
We take the juice and then we encapsulate it in tiny droplets. So inside each droplet, we still have strawberry juice, for example. And then these droplets link together to create a shape. So we design a shape on a mobile app. So for example, you want a square strawberry, and then you feed it with strawberry juice, or you could have it half of it strawberry, half of it something else, maybe perhaps cream. And that gets built into that shape with a 3D printer.
Right, so this printer just creates this three-dimensional shape. So it's time to forget about printing being done with ink on paper. This is different. The droplets come out of the printer and into a bowl of liquid, and the printer has a couple of moving arms so that each of the droplets lands in exactly the right position in the liquid, and because of that, the shape you want is built up.
Exactly.
And how long would it take to make a smallish cube of strawberry?
Probably just under a minute.
What are the applications?
So we're exploring this type of 3D printing technique in food because it's kind of novel to create something that is a 3D structure, but inside, when you bite into it, it's still a liquid.
But a lot of what we consume day in, day out is in liquid form, so we think this is a really interesting technology to package those things and allow you to do things with those liquids that you can't do currently.
So what could you do with, let's say, something quite commonplace like orange juice?
With things like juices, a lot of what our technology is doing is allowing you to kind of creatively experiment with food. So you can kind of change the shape, you can change the texture, you can change the colour if you want. There's the magic of creating the illusion of something that looks like one foodstuff and then tastes like another, which can be quite magical. We've spoken to lots of parents who want to be able to create things made from vegetable puree which actually look like fun shapes, planes, trains, automobiles, all that kind of stuff. So there's that kind of magic. I think also, if you think from an environmental perspective, sustainability perspective, being able to package things in a way that the packaging is part of the actual juice that you're eating or consuming has great implications for reducing packaging. Not so much orange juice, but an example that comes to mind is if you think about runners need to hydrate themselves with water, we can actually use our process to package water such that it has a physical form that you could handle. So you could imagine, when I go for my run, I put a few little sort of berries of water in my pocket, and when I need them, I kind of get them out and I consume them, and it's still liquid water inside, but I've packaged it in such a way that it doesn't need any plastic around it. We think that could be quite novel in itself.
From the point of view of chefs, there's a lot of sort of quite experimental chefs around, aren't there? People like Heston Blumenthal, but some of the chefs in Cambridge as well, like Daniel Clifford and Mark Poynton. Is there an application in fine dining, do you think?
Absolutely. We have been talking to a few high-end chefs, and chefs have been struggling to create kind of an interesting looking sheets that they can serve their dishes on. We've been able to kind of 3D print different flavors that work on the same dish. An example would be a beetroot base, so a sheet of beetroot sauce that could be potentially served with another kind of salmon on top. And also working with materials that are sometimes really hard for chefs to handle, such as oils, acidic liquids. A lot of traditional molecular gastronomy techniques don't work with those particular ingredients. So we found a technique that actually allows us to manage. So we've been looking at kind of creating beautiful looking dressings that are kind of get released just in time as you're having your salad.
The way we encapsulate liquids, we can do it in such a way that they don't mix until you bite into them or you cut into them. So you can imagine for chefs that might be quite exciting, because you can have two things which are separately encapsulated, and then the moment somebody bites into them, there's a reaction that takes place, or the flavours mix, or something new happens that is initiated by the diner, by the person eating the meal.
Can you foresee a time when most people's domestic kitchens will have a food printer?
Absolutely. That's what Robert has been working and I have been working on this kind of vision. And the way that we've designed the machine is to make sure that it takes very little footprint in the kitchen. It looks beautiful to watch while it's making your raspberries for breakfast. And we've also optimized it in a way that it will become affordable for everyday kitchen.
Do fruits which are out of season become more accessible?
That's a really interesting question. We have been looking at areas where fresh produce is really hard to come by, and also when things are out of season, and kind of also looking at the flavors of fruits that are out of season. So, for example, when we buy blueberries or raspberries in this time of year, they don't taste as delicious or as sweet as they would when they kind of picked ripe in the right season. So we have been looking at ways to preserve seasonal kind of ingredients and then reconstructing them out of season.
So the liquid that you extract from them when they're in season and at their peak, you can actually... You're looking at ways of preserving that so that you can rebuild the fruit out of season.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And when you extract the flavours, is there a method by which you can intensify the flavours?
We can tailor the liquid that we're working with in order to create something that's very intense, which for the types of things that we're doing, we're kind of creating or embodying sauces and garnishes and things that complement dishes. You really want that very intense burst of flavour to excite the palate and to complement the food that's on the plate. So intensity of flavour, I think, is something that's kind of tightly entwined with what we're working.
Any local chefs who you think might be interested in this sort of thing?
Oh, definitely. I think we're keen to work with anybody who sort of works at the leading edge of cuisine and high dining, and we've been having conversations with some interesting chefs and characters, and so that's an active development. I guess we're not sort of naming names at the moment.
Okay. I think we're all guessing names.
But, no, there are people we've spoken to who are very excited about this, and there are people we'd really love to work with, so we're open to all sorts of collaborations and projects where people want to get involved.
Well, I was very keen to see what a fruit printer actually looked like, little thinking that an object on the table was one.
I imagine the printers are actually probably quite large and take up a lot of space, Robert. Is that going to put people off?
We think those are things that would put people off, so that's why we've deliberately designed something that is as small as possible, has a beautifully compact footprint. We play on this idea of theatre in creating our 3D printed food, so the way that the machine opens out, it's like a piece of origami. It's very beautiful to watch as it composes and creates the edible creation in the bath underneath. It's all been about creating this very beautiful, elegant experience. And kitchen appliances are things that people have to live with every day. They have to kind of fall in love with them. There has to be that emotional connection. And so this is very much a kitchen appliance, a domestic appliance, a kind of beautiful consumer product. It isn't a kind of tool or an ugly piece of equipment that gets relegated to a workshop. So,
and this is it on the table here, is it?
Yes, yes.
Well, it is absolutely beautiful. I'm absolutely amazed. And small.
Well, yes, we've worked very hard to package the internal electronics in such a way that you get this very compact footprint and you get this elegant form, which to the kind of casual observer, it's not obvious how it works, and we think there's a great deal of magic in the way that it opens out, and the printing process creates this little dance as this arm moves over the printing bath underneath.
Yeah.
I think it's just shy of 25 centimetres, so yeah. It's, for anybody listening at home, it's similar in proportion to a kind of kettle, I guess, is the best analogy in terms of the footprint. And the
That's a lot more beautiful than a kettle, and a lot more interesting
Thank
looking
you.
As
Thank
well.
You for saying
yeah,
so.
Yeah, yeah. And you're doing an event at Eat Cambridge. Can you tell us something about that?
We are running two pop-up evenings where we'll be cooking delicious food, and each dish, each course will be accessorized with three 3D printed elements. So it will be everything from palate cleansers, starters, appetizers, all the way through the main course and dessert. And we will be looking at how people perceive flavors and textures.
Right, so people will be able to book for that.
Yes.
Fairly soon.
Yes.
Right, excellent. Thanks very much.
Well, that's all very exciting. The meal at Eat Cambridge is described as an experiential five-course meal. They say that each course will look to embrace a different sense and allow you to use our 3D food printer to design and print edibles for each plate. Upon arrival, you will be greeted with a 3D printed cocktail and welcomed into our studio, which we will have transformed into an experiential dining room. For each plate of food, you'll be able to design and print further accompaniments to make each dish truly unique. Alfie Fowler, the cook, has worked in the catering industry for 7 years, including under a chef who was the manager of the first pub in London to get a Michelin star. He's a trained product designer with a genuine love of food. So look out for details in the Eat Cambridge programme, and that will be out at the end of the month.
Weekdays from 4.
105 Drive with Julian Clover.
We last had one in flower in 2004, so people have been waiting a long time.
I'll be campaigning strongly for us to stay, and I would expect Cambridge to vote strongly in favour.
Quite a controversial piece, but it is coming to Cambridge.
We've got the latest news, sport, weather and travel every 20 minutes. Some great conversation, all of Cambridge, on your way home. It's 105 Drive, and it all starts weekdays at 4pm on Community Radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
Novi on Regent Street is featuring a lot in food blogs and on Twitter, as it regularly hosts street food and pop-ups like Steak and Honour, Gorilla Kitchen and Buffalo Joe's.
Their website says that it adds interest and variety on top of their own wares, so there's always something different to try. One of the newest local independents to arrive at Novi is Allotment Cafe.
And flavour reporter Pina Broccoli Anaya caught up with the owner to discover her breakfast and lunch options and what it is that she does differently.
I'm here with Katie Moore, the owner of Allotment. It's a pop-up cafe and bakery making food with Cambridgeshire produce, inspired by Katie's allotment. She always bases her menu around what produce is being grown locally and tries to source as much from the region as possible. The emphasis is on fresh, healthy food, including vegan options. So tell us a bit about your background in food and how Allotment came to be.
So my background in food, I guess, just comes from eating great food growing up. My mum is a really good cook and my grandma was an amazing baker. But I started my career in advertising and realised pretty quickly on that my side projects in baking and supplying food was what I really loved and where I wanted my future to be. So I took a trip to Shanghai with a friend and we worked on a cafe and bakery out there, which was an amazing experience and just completely reinforced the fact that that's the industry that I wanted to be a part of and the people that I wanted to be surrounded by. And so when I came back to the UK and moved to Cambridgeshire, I was just amazed by how much amazing produce there was in the region. And we were growing a lot of fresh produce on our own allotment. It was just so novel and inspiring being able to walk out into the garden each day, pick some vegetables and an hour later they're on the table. I realised that that was the direction I wanted the business to go in, and I wanted it to be inspired by the English garden and the Cambridgeshire produce and create some hopefully really delicious dishes with those ingredients.
I love your tagline, locally grown like you've never seen it. You certainly make some beautiful dishes. I know you're providing breakfast and lunch at Novi on Regent Street. So what's on the menu there?
I'm there Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Thursday and Friday, we sort of split it into breakfast and lunch. So there's just some light breakfast options, a really lovely nutty seedy granola with some delicious apple compote. And one of my favourite things is the toasted English muffins with the beetroot hummus, which is also on the brunch menu. I'm such a sucker for an English muffin. So everything is homemade, all the bread and the muffins. And the beetroot hummus has just been a real staple over autumn, winter, where there's a lot of root vegetables. So finding ways of incorporating them in different ways is a really fun challenge. And it's this beautiful, vibrant, pink, garlicky, deep, delicious hummus. And then the lunch menu is a little bit lighter and brighter with some salads. And we use flour from Foster's Mill to make some really lovely handmade sourdough, which we bake fresh each morning. And so it changes kind of on a weekly basis, depending on what produce is available. So some of the salads that I've been really, really loving the past few weeks have been with root vegetables. There's some beautiful purple carrots, which I adore, and the rainbow spectrum of beetroots from the golden through the candy stripe and into that really deep purple beetroot. And one of my favorite things is to sort of make them into these curled ribbons and just serve them really simply with a citrus dressing or roasted and citrus glaze. So we use beautiful oranges and lemons and sort of baste them in this citrus glaze while they're cooking, so they get kind of sticky and sweet. When you pair that with something creamy like our homemade ricotta and a little bit of crunch from some seeds, it's just a really tasty, packed full of nutrients, and it's ready to sort of set you up for the afternoon.
Certainly feel very healthy when I have some of your food. And that only looks beautiful because that's nature's palette right there.
Exactly.
It's actually, you know, you feel really healthy and coupled with a, you know, smoothie or something from Novi. It's a really nice lunch.
Yeah, and I think it really came from the sort of food that I want to eat, and the sort of food that doesn't weigh you down through the day. It lifts your spirit, it gives you energy, it, you know, revitalizes you, and especially through the winter, you really want to be packing your body full of vitamins and nutrients so that you can stay fit and healthy. And like you say, when it looks really inviting, I think I really love to eat that kind of food. So, and then at the weekend, I like to indulge a little bit. So we do things like the rye pancakes, which are these lovely light pancakes with poached pears, which we poach in sugar syrup with some rosemary and leave them to steep overnight. So they really have a delicious, soft, sweet, juicy flavor with some candied seeds. So pumpkin seeds and sunflower seeds are so versatile and they have so much goodness in them. So we candy them, we sometimes do them toasted with some spice, or even just on their own, they just add a really lovely texture. And I think when you've got something soft and fluffy, you kind of need a bit of bite to it.
Now, your cakes and sweet treats are just making a sensation all over the place. And you have vegan options too, which people are flocking to have. Tell us about some of the cakes that you do.
Yeah, so that's kind of where I started originally, was baking. And I was doing a really lovely market in London before I went to China. I sort of imagined that that's the path that I'd continue down. And so I wanted that to be a really central part of this business and make some really interesting flavour combinations that veered away from your traditional Victoria sponge but weren't completely alien. And then this vegan market just kind of popped up. I became very aware quite quickly that there was a lot of demand for it, and not many places in Cambridge do that many vegan options. So I think it was my very first day at Novi. We put this carrot and parsnip vegan cake on the counter, and it just sold out. And then people were putting it on Instagram and talking about it on social media. And I now can't take it off the counter. So I don't know what will happen when we run out of carrots and parsnips, but we'll find some other delicious things to put in it. I really like it anyway, because it's just really, really moist. And I think even though sometimes the texture is not as light and fluffy as a traditional cake with eggs and butter and flour, it's really moist because we use olive oil and obviously the carrots have a lot of moisture, but I quite like that. It's super indulgent.
And you just decorate them so beautifully, and you have like, you know, pink frostings and things.
Yeah.
How do you come up with those ideas? You got like dried fruit on them to decorate them.
I don't know. I think, like you said earlier, nature's palette is so diverse and so enticing. So I try to use natural flavourings and natural colourings. So the pink frosting is coloured with the beetroot juice from where we roast the beetroots. Ah. We sort of keep the juice. And then the dried fruits and things, they keep their colour really beautifully, and they also sometimes make really interesting shapes. So it's nice to get a little bit of height or texture into things. And then through the summer, it's once we get things growing, you can start putting lovely edible flowers in. I'm really lucky at the garden at home, we have a beautiful edible flower cutting area. So dahlias and violas and pansies and all sorts, hopefully we'll be making an appearance.
Looking forward to that. That's going to be lovely.
Yeah, absolutely. Bring on summer.
Yeah. You do one right now that it's really good for, I think, this time of the year. It's a brownie.
It's dangerous because I find myself eating brownies for breakfast all too often. So the salted caramel brownies are something that I've been kind of tweaking the recipe for a couple of years. But I think they're a pretty good place now. So they're just really, really gooey and dense and moorish and delicious in the middle. And then I think teamed with the pears on top, you get that kind of fruity, a bit sharpness, which cuts through it. So you don't feel quite so guilty about eating it, but they're still delicious.
You're eating fruit at the end of the
day. Exactly. It's 1 in 5 a day.
So are you supplying any other places in Cambridge or Cambridgeshire?
Well, the really nice thing about Cambridgeshire and all the people that I've met so far is that everyone is incredibly supportive and generous. So when I first started at Novi, I was really lucky to meet some people who kind of just started spreading the word for me, which was amazing. And as part of that, one of the people that got in touch with the deli at Burwash, so the larder at Burwash Manor, I now have supplied them twice a week with salads and sausage rolls, which are so delicious because we're using the meat from the pigs on the farm. So it's really nice to just be able to keep things in, just, you can't get more local than that.
And so, they're award-winning sausages as well from Burwash.
They really are delicious. Honestly, driving sausage rolls that are fresh out of the oven, the 40-minute drive to Burwash Manor on a Saturday morning is kind of impossible. But that is really nice because I think the market, also the demographic of people that go there, they're all just so interested in fresh, delicious local produce, and it's a really good fit. But we've also had interest for birthday cakes and events, and that's really nice because you can make it a lot more personal and play to people's themes and their colours and their taste palettes. And I love being able to work kind of one-on-one with people, so that's really nice.
Fantastic. Allotment is popping up at Novi at 12 Regent Street, where Katie prepares breakfast and lunch Thursdays to Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Find her on Twitter and Facebook at Allotment Cafe. Thank you so much for your time, Katie. We wish you well with your venture.
Thank you, Pina. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Flavour reporter Pina Broccoli and Naya. Pina pops up regularly at the latest food happenings in the city. She's tweeting, photographing, and writing about them in her blog 12culinarystew.com.
Now on to one of our occasional features, On the Menu. This time, Alan spoke with Mark Poynton, chef patron of the excellent and Michelin-starred Alimentum in Hills Road.
So our first dish is one that's just coming into season, is a savran of wild garlic with Jerusalem artichoke and langoustines. So wild garlic is a foraged herb which tastes like garlic, looks nothing like garlic. It's a big long green leaf which we take out of the ground, wash it, plunge it into boiling water, straight into ice water. Then we dehydrate it for 24 hours and powder it to intensify the flavour. Then we add this into a chicken mousse, and that goes inside a savran mould. And basically a savran mould is like a rhubarb, so it's like a donut shape. But before we do that, we wrap it in spaghetti. So you've got spaghetti around the outside, wild garlic mousse on the inside, and then we cook that to order for 4 minutes. And then on top of that is langoustine tails, crispy Jerusalem artichokes and Jerusalem artichoke puree. So it's a really earthy dish. We've finished with a little bit of caviar as well for a little bit of indulgence. So that's quite a new and interesting dish we do at the moment.
Yeah, it sounds good. It also sounds quite labour-intensive, is it?
Everything we do is labour-intensive. It looks simple, but yeah, it takes a long time. It takes about 15 minutes to do one. From start to finish, and then obviously the cooking process, and it takes about 30 seconds to eat it, so
yes, and distressing.
Yeah.
And are you getting good feedback on it?
Yeah, customers love it. We went on the menu last week and we've probably sold about 30 already, which is quite good for us.
How long will it last, Mark, because wild garlic isn't going to be around?
Well, wild garlic started early this year. It doesn't normally start till May, same time as asparagus, but obviously started in February, so hopefully the season will be prolonged and we'll still get it to the end of June like normal.
Yeah, well, that would be good. Right, yeah. Okay.
Next dish.
Another
squab pigeon. It's a farmed pigeon from France, Anjou in France, and we serve the whole bird. So we poach the pigeon breasts and slow cook the legs. One leg we serve on the bone, and one leg we serve through what we call a boudin blanc, or a white sausage. So the leg meat goes through the white sausage, we poach the sausage and then roast it off. That's served with burnt apple puree, cabbage, blackberries, and pickled apple. And then we finish up with blackberry vinegar, which is quite nice and acidic. But yeah, it's the same thing. It's a labour-intensive dish, but on the plate it's really simple. Just looks like a pigeon with a pigeon leg.
But tastes good, no doubt.
Tastes very good, yeah. Tastes very good.
Yeah. Now, the two that you've mentioned, they're on your sort of, what I suppose I'd call the main menu. They're not on the set price menus. No. And I think you're probably quite unusual, are you, in having really quite a distinct set price menu?
Yeah, with the set price menu, we always do three choices, meat, vegetarian, and a fish course. So the pigeon dish, the squab pigeon dish on the a la carte, or the set menu, or the main menu, if you want to call it, is quite, well, it's very expensive. It's nearly, the whole dish in itself is nearly £10 just to put on a plate. So by the time we had overheads and stuff like that, we wouldn't be able to fit into a £29 menu. So we do actually do the same dish, but with wood pigeons instead, which is considerably cheaper and also shot locally. So yeah, you can still have some of the dishes which are similar, but not the same. So there'll always be something which is, you know, you can think, oh, I might want to try that. It's going to be on the main menu, but I'll try it on here first, see if I like it. And we try and do that to bring value into it, because it's £65 for three courses, which in hindsight is actually five courses plus complimentary bread and canapes. So we try to always keep it a value. And then it's the same for the £29 menu as well. You still get the complimentary bread, the canapes, the pre-starter, and the pre-dessert as well, so...
Yeah, I think, you know, people who haven't been to a Michelin star restaurant and come and have the fixed price menu, I don't think they always realise that they are treated extremely well, just as any customer would be, and that's...
Yeah, exactly. It's because, you know, if you go to a chain restaurant, I won't name any, if you go to any chain restaurant, you have to pay for bread, you have to pay for olives. If you want a little pre-starter, you have to pay for it, whereas here you don't. It's straight £29. For the three courses. And also, in the month of March, we're giving all NHS staff 20% off the final bill, so it's even more value if you work for the hospital.
Yeah, which my daughter does, so...
A third dish is a new beef dish, which is actually going on today. I was lucky enough to go to Belfast last month to see a beef supplier called Peter Hannan, and he dry-ages his beef in Himalayan salt room. He's the first person to do it in the UK. And the beef's dry-aged for 80 days. It's a longhorn beef from Glen Arm Estate in just outside Belfast. So we're using the sirloin, we're slow roasting the sirloin, and that's getting served with the sweetbreads from the cow, beef fat potatoes, parsley puree, wild mushrooms, and a rich red wine sauce. So
that sounds fantastic. Yeah. What does the 80 days do?
So it's maturing of the flavour, and it helps the marbling of the fat as well.
Right, but presumably drying out somewhat as well with the salt.
It doesn't dry out so much. The salt is more for killing the bacteria. And it adds flavour as well, because it's not in contact with the salt, so it doesn't dry it out. But you only lose about 2 inches either side of where the beef's, you know, breathing where the salt is. So it's not too bad, but it just intensifies that real beef flavour.
You've got eels on the menu. In fact, when I came last, I had eels. Yeah. Are there still eels to be found locally?
There's still some eeling in Ely and a little bit on the River Cam, but it's classed as an endangered species now, so the farming's not as much as it was. But we buy our eels from the Dutch Eel Company, which are sustainable, and the eels are grown, farmed in Holland, and then brought over into the fisheries over here, and then done that way. So yeah, no, we always have a smoked eel dish on, because for me it's one of my favourite ingredients, so it's something that we can play with quite a lot.
Yeah, it's nice eel. I think people who haven't tried it probably dread it. But
yeah, of course. Well, especially around this area as well, where it was famous for it originally, so yeah. I think people should try it.
Yeah, it's right that it's on a menu of a Cambridge restaurant.
Exactly.
Yeah. As well as doing what you do Monday to Saturday, you also have a Sunday supper club. And you try dishes out on that?
Yeah, so that's first Sunday of every month. We do a five-course menu. And it's basically new dishes that I want to put on the menu. And so the customers are guinea pigs, so to speak. So we only do 40 people. It's all communal eating, where people get to talk about the dishes and rate the dishes and say if they're good or bad out of 1 to 10. And yeah, it's very popular. Fully booked till July at the minute, so...
And you get people rebooking, coming every time, I guess.
We get a lot of people rebooking, and it is people will book far in advance because they'll make an event of it and they'll, because they don't normally get to speak to the chef and tell them what they feel, you know, unless it's TripAdvisor. So quite a nice way of doing it.
Yeah, and do you think people are frank or do they feel the need to be nice to you?
I think it's a mix of both. Some people think they're AA Gill and some people are quite polite and just think, you know, say if it's wonderful. But so you have to pick and choose which ones you listen to.
And that was Mark Poynton from Alimentum. And there's a neat Cambridge event that Mark's involved in. It's an intimate lunchtime demo with Mark, featuring a cooking demonstration of two signature dishes, including how to put together a plate of food perfectly. And that's followed by a bespoke five-course tasting lunch with an optional matching flight of wine. It's £50 a head, plus £20 for the optional wine flight. Reservations, which are essential, can be made via Eat Cambridge. And, as we said earlier, the details will be launched on its website at the end of the month.
Every fortnight, Bums on Seats brings debate and discussion on the latest movie releases. From blockbusters to art house, our panel of reviewers are passionate about film.
There's one thing in common, and that's that I think they're all absolutely brilliant.
Well, you can see the ending by watching the trailer, because I was surprised they show it in the trailer.
You wouldn't know it was the ending if you hadn't just said it was the ending.
And we'll agree to disagree.
No, I don't agree.
Hosted by Toby Miller.
We take the latest cinema releases for a dance and a drink and report back on which ones have turned our eye and captured our heart and which ones will be blanking in the street if we happen to pass them.
Join the team. Alternate Saturdays at 12 noon on Community Radio in your city. Cambridge 105.
Just got time for some tweets now, so over to Alan.
Yeah, some tweets that have come in this morning. Gorilla Kitchen have tweeted to say that they are at the C3 Centre in Coldham's Lane until 3 o'clock today, and tonight they'll be at Thirsty in Chesterton Road from 6 till 9 p.m. The Black Bar Brewery in Harston is open till 2, selling beer. Food Park, the night market, has been announced. It returns on the 21st of May. And tickets will be on sale at the end of March. And they're also going to be there on the 25th of June, the 30th of July and the 27th of August. And I'm sure we'll be reminding you of those. And some personal food news. This morning I had a Cobb's Bakery hot cross bun. I don't know whether two have had any.
I haven't.
Cobb's Bakery hot cross buns. They're really good, and I recommend them.
They'll be doing loads of those at the moment, won't they? Because it's Easter time, so this is when their big hot cross bun explosion occurs.
Yeah, I got mine at the Derby Stalls in Newnham, and the next delivery for people who are heading that way is on Monday morning. So.
Now, what can we do in our own kitchen? If you're a bit jaded with the fresh vegetables that are on sale at this time of year, Nazima Pathan from Frongley Kitchen has some very enticing ideas for cauliflower.
Nazima, you've got some ideas for cauliflower.
Indeed, yes. Apart from the usual steamed veg side or having it in a cheese sauce, it's increasingly becoming a star vegetable and often a main course vegetable. So sort of cooking it in different ways. It's been used a lot in Indian cooking, as people will recognise, within curries and within biryani rice, for example, particularly with potatoes and things, aloo gobi, lovely curry. But now people are using it as a centrepiece. So, for example, the big trend last year, and it continues, is roasting whole vegetables, such as cauliflower. And what we would suggest is first steam it, because it's very big, steam it for a bit, and then stick it in the oven on a low temperature and roast it for ages. What it does is that caramelises it and gives a really nice flavour. And people will often serve that up, you know, sliced into thick slices as a cauliflower steak, essentially, which sounds a bit radical.
I roasted cauliflower last week for the first time. And it was very nice.
It just gets a nice texture, doesn't it?
Just exactly what I was going to say. It has a nice texture.
It doesn't, because you're not boiling it to death, it has still has that nice pleasant crunch of a raw cauliflower, but is, again, slightly more digestible, I suppose, and not quite as sharp in taste. And, you know, we've often, with supper clubs, what we've done is we don't do the whole roast cauliflower. We've done florets of it. And then if you still roast that and char it a little bit, you can even put some parmesan over it and some olive oil or other sort of toppings. And then once you've cooked it, you know, you can put chimichurri sauce or any other kind of herbal dressings. It'd be really interesting. It can take on lots of flavours. So it's a nice way of doing it. So that's one idea. Then another interesting thing is that people are doing these days is using it again as a meat substitute. So sort of roast slices of cauliflower, which they call cauliflower steak, they are then putting that into burgers. So you can make a vegetarian burger, but without, you know, a beanie burger, have a cauliflower steak in it. And by dressing it up and putting all kinds of interesting sauces and other and toppings on, it's just a different way of doing it. And so just as you have, for example, buffalo chicken wings, you'll see on Pinterest and on the internet buffalo cauliflower, where you will make cauliflower fritters, fry them, and then put them with buffalo sauce. It's because it has a kind of decent texture that can hold up to cooking, yeah. And a nice flavour.
That sounds rather nice, actually.
Well, if you're vegetarian and you're not a huge tofu fan, I think offers a good substitute for a lot of meat. Interestingly, Yota Matulangi is a big cauliflower fan, and last year he put out a recipe which a lot of people made, which was a savoury cake, essentially a cake made with cauliflower, red onion, herbs, some bit of turmeric, and then, you know, a nice big thick cake, which I guess would be a lovely breakfast kind of cake. So that was quite interesting. And then another interesting couple of developments that people do is with all the trend for low-carb living. Two ways of using cauliflower. One is that if you put florets or cauliflower into a blender with a load of water and whiz it for a couple of seconds, not too much that it turns into juice, the first thing it's going to do is blitz it into very fine grains that look like rice or couscous, and then you can drain that off. And it only takes about 5 seconds if you've got a decent high-speed blender. And you can cook that, say, stir-fry it, and make it like a sort of couscous or a rice base. It's called cauliflower rice, in fact, and it's low-fat, it's healthy, and it actually tastes quite nice, and it's not too strongly flavoured, so that's a nice dish. And then another new trend is that is the use of cauliflower with egg whites and almonds to make a kind of batter that you can bake to make a base for pizza. So cauliflower crust pizza, which is low-fat-ish because it's got almonds in it, gives it a bit of structure and holds it together, but low-fat, and again, it's totally grain-free, gluten-free. So it's an interesting way of having a pizza if you are not wanting to have a normal pizza base. And, I think it tastes quite nice because a lot of people are making it, so that's just another idea. So, yeah. Right. I really like cauliflower. It's great.
A surprisingly diverse range of ideas.
Yeah, that's the lot.
Right, okay.
There's some really good ideas there. Cauliflower burgers, buffalo cauliflower, pizza base. It's great.
Yeah, and that Yotam Ottolenghi dish sounds good too, I thought. Is cauliflower used much in Spain, Ruth?
I think so. I mean, one of my favourite dishes as a kid was always, it's like a cauliflower cheese, but instead of a cheese sauce, they use a bechamel on top. And then you put that in the oven with the cooked cauliflower, and I loved it. And I think that's something that most kids in Spain have had, I imagine.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you still have it?
Oh, yeah, all the time. It's still one of my favourite dishes. And it's easy to do too.
Good.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
The weather's gradually warming up, sort of-ish. It's a slow process, but I think so. Maybe I'm delusional, who knows? So it's probably time to start sowing some vegetable seeds. Alan asked Dave Fox of Trumpington Allotments what we should be doing.
Well, one thing we can do is have a look at their compost heap, which has been rotting down for about the last year or so, and it's a bit dry actually, this one, so a lot of the material's not rotted down very well, but there's a good rich seam of moist, well rotted stuff here, so I'm going to dig that out, put it in the wheelbarrow, and then get it onto the land. So we'll take it over to the bed where I'm actually going to plant French beans, and they won't go in till May. So the idea is that the compost will sit on the bed until then, feed the soil, the earthworms and everybody else will come up, start eating the compost, take the organic matter down into the soil. Remember, we're not digging here, so we're just putting the nutrient-rich material on the top and feeding the crop in advance, so to speak.
Yeah, so the fact that it isn't absolutely completely all rotted down doesn't matter terribly much because that process will continue, I guess.
That's right, yeah. I mean, a bit more rotted than this would be better, but never mind. I mean, this stuff is free. You know, we've made this ourselves on site from material here, so it's okay that it's sort of a grade two quality. Another function this has is if we put it on reasonably thickly, it will suppress weed growth. So by the time late May comes, when we want to sow our French beans, we can hopefully just stick them into the ground and not have too much weeding to do, and the compost will have decayed and reduced a bit by then. Of course, if the compost heap didn't get very hot, we might have some weed seeds left in there. So we might be introducing a whole new selection of weeds to this bed, but hopefully not. And anyway, if weeds do come up in here, at least they'll have had to struggle through the compost, so they'll be a bit weaker and easier to pull out.
Yeah.
So that's something you can be getting on with at the moment when it's still a bit too cold to put a lot of seeds in. You can prepare the beds. I wouldn't have done this job in late autumn, because then the heavy winter rain would have washed a lot of nutrients away. It's better to put your compost and manure on in the spring, especially on well-drained soils. One thing we certainly can sow now is peas. So I've got here a bed prepared for some meteor peas. These are a summer pea. They're wrinkled. They've got a wrinkled surface, as opposed to the smooth surface peas, which are the ones that you sow for overwintering. So this bed is. I've just made a shallow depression about 15 centimetres wide, and sieved some pretty good compost in there. And sowing the peas is not a precise science. I'm just sprinkling them in, and what I'm aiming for is to have the peas spaced at about 5 centimetres apart, so that each plant's got a reasonable amount of space to grow in independently of the others. So now that I've scattered the peas in, let's get down to ground level, push them in, and where there's several peas too close together, just move them apart and just press them in. Press some a bit deeper, as they'll come up later. It's not a bad idea, leave some on the surface and put some in quite deep. So if the mice or pigeons or somebody else comes along, eats the first lot, there'll be a second wave of seedlings to outwit them, hopefully.
Will it be necessary to thin them at all, do you think?
No. Peas, they sort of find their space because these are going to grow sort of 2-3 foot tall, so they'll find their space. And we're going to put some sticks in, hopefully, if I can buy some pea sticks from the Allotment Society trading shed this morning. We'll get some nice twiggy hazel sticks to support the peas as they grow, and they'll all find their own space.
So they're quite an easy crop to start off anyway.
Yes, that's right. They do get pests, though. The trouble with peas, I mean, they're absolutely delicious, but you've got to catch them when they're ready, because after a couple of days they get a little bit dry, less sweet, and then the dreaded pea moth is going to start laying its eggs in there, and you're going to get larva infesting the crop. So it's... hopefully we'll get a couple of weeks of pickings of peas. I've already sown one variety in this bed. The rest of the bed is going to be this variety, Meteor, and then I've got another bed where I'm going to put another two varieties of peas in. So I'm hoping for a succession of crops. And that's something to think about in general. Don't put all your seed in at once. For a lot of fast-growing crops, I'm thinking peas, carrots, spinach, lettuce especially, radish, all the small stuff, like a summer cabbage. Sow some now, sow some in a few weeks, sow some a few weeks later. Make, if you've got space and time, make 3 or 4 sowings, and then you can have a succession of pickings of young succulent stuff. There's a bed here I've warmed slightly by putting some old secondary double glazing on to warm the soil up underneath. So I'm going to take that off now and sow some parsnips. So off comes the glass, taking care not to break it, just got away with that. And we can see that a few weeds have grown underneath the glass, so we'll give it a last little hoe. They're just moving the hoe just under the soil surface to chop off any little weeds, including one or two that we can't see. There's some grass, and be a bit more aggressive with that, make sure I get the root out. So there we have a wonderful, completely weed-free fine tilth textbook bed to put the seed in. So I'm going to mark out a nice straight line. I really do think sowing veg in straight lines is a good idea. The reason for that is that I do my weed control through the summer primarily by hoeing, and it's just so much easier to hoe along a straight line than to go around. So, you know, if you want a pretty garden with things sown in circles and spirals and everything, that's absolutely fine, but do think about how you're going to do your weed control. Got a thin nylon string here, stretched between a couple of sticks and held taut. So that's nice and straight. And I'm going to use a hoe just to make a shallow depression along the line of the string. It's called a drill. Doesn't need to be too deep, a couple of centimetres. And now here comes the parsnip seed. It's nice fresh parsnip seed. This is always a good idea to use recently purchased parsnip seed. It doesn't keep. A lot of things keep for several years if kept in good conditions, but parsnip's one of those that doesn't really keep very long. So with the parsnips, because I want a small number of large roots rather than a large number of small roots, I'm going to aim to have one root growing every maybe 5 to 10 centimeters, something like that. So we're going to try to arrange for that by sowing two or three seeds. It's called station sowing. We're sowing two or three seeds there, and then about 8 centimeters along, another three seeds.
Right, so you're putting them together in...
Yeah, I'm putting three seeds at each point, just so that, so that's just to allow for one to fail, one to get eaten and one to grow. We might have to come along and thin those out. There we are, so we've got to the end of the row with approximately three seeds at each station. The thing with parsnips is they take quite a long time to germinate. So it's a really nice idea to put something fast growing, fast maturing in between the parsnips so we can see where the line is. And here I'm going to use some radish. I'm going to put two or three radish seeds along the line in between the stations where we've got the triplets of parsnip seeds. So what's going to happen in a few weeks' time is we're going to see a row of radishes up here. And we can hoe along that, do the weed control, enjoy our crop of radishes, and as we pull the radishes out, we'll notice the little parsnip seedlings coming up. There we are, so a few radish seeds between each parsnip station, and now we're going to cover all the seeds. We could just move the soil over the top, but actually I prefer to use some spent compost. This came out of my old tomato grow bags that I used last summer. I'm just going to cover the seeds in the drill with this spent compost, which is quite dark in colour. That's got a couple of advantages. It's free of weed seed, and because it's a different colour to the soil, it's another way of helping me to see exactly where the row is. Mm. Then we just tap it down, and there we are.
Wow.
Here we are in March, and we're hoping to start digging them after the frosts in November. And having the best ones for Christmas dinner, of course.
Mm.
Christmas dinner, that seems a long way off, doesn't it?
I'm looking forward to it, though.
Well, thanks to Dave Fox for that, and we look forward to Dave being back with us in 4 weeks' time.
At Cambridge 105, we're always out and about in our city. If you'd like us to be at your event, email publicity@cambridge105.fm. Supporting our community for over 5 years. Cambridge 105.
There are some good wines about at the moment, and Dan Young from Noel Young Wines in Trumpington told me about some of them.
Some really good, vibrant wines coming through, some 2015 whites from Europe in particular, which is on the back of, in general, a fairly tough vintage with 14. So it's nice to see some of these back on form, a lot more sort of depth to them. I think you could certainly argue that there was a little bit of a lack of depth to some of the 2014s. It was quite wet, so there was a little bit of a hollow feel to some of the 14. So 15's back on form. One of the wines we're going to focus on is a fantastic Sicilian Inzolia, which is an indigenous grape variety, local to Sicily, northern Sicily. So I'm from Curatolo Arini. Very sort of bright, refreshing, almost a kind of a gin and tonic type of white. Quite zesty, got that citrus saline feel going through. So very much a real sort of palate awakener, if you like. So great as an aperitif, certainly very, very good with good quality fish, nice salads if we're sort of getting to that sort of stage, with that sort of feel to it, so really lovely. That we retail that for just over £9.
Sounds very reasonable. The Sicilian wines are often quite expensive or not very good.
Yeah, there's still a lot of variability, definitely. I think if you're out and you don't know, then names like Planeta would definitely be one to sort of keep in the notebook, so to speak, as a very safe option. They definitely a winery that you could say have firmly put Sicily back on the map. They do make a consistent range of really good local variety wines. So if not this, then look out for Planeta. They're very good.
Right, OK. And you've got a red there as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, absolutely. When you talk about value, you know, Pinot Noir, for example, is not necessarily a great variety that's always associated with value. And this one from Catalina Sounds is from New Zealand. Again, a lot of the focus with New Zealand on Pinot Noir in particular has been Central Otago, with very good reason, because the wines from there are generally outstanding, but the prices are pretty high, so you're looking at sort of maybe £17 to £20 as a starting point, so quite expensive. So nice to get this one in from Marlborough, so south of the North Island. This one just comes in at just under £14, but it's very classic of the style, very varietal. You've got that lovely sweet raspberry, strawberry fruit, quite light, but not lacking. It's not too light. Still has plenty of depth. And it's very Pinot. Sometimes we try a lot of wines from perhaps Europe, some Pinot Noirs from Europe, that at this sort of price level, they really are quite average. You don't get a lot of flavour to them. This definitely has that. It's very clean style, a little bit of spice, touch of oak, but that's a seasoning rather than a dominant flavour, you know, so just a little bit of that to enhance that natural sort of sweet fruit. So it's delicious, and it's the first time it's been back in the UK this for 5 or 6 years, so we're really happy it's back.
Why has it been away?
Sometimes if a winery has a change of representation in a country, then there can be a little bit of a gap in between somebody stopping taking the wines and somebody new taking over.
But, yeah. How much is it, Ben?
£13.99.
And Pinot is a very distinctive wine, isn't it?
Definitely.
Does everybody like it, or do people who are more used to, say, Shiraz, finding it a bit, it's a bit odd?
Yeah, whether they find it odd, I think certainly if you're a Shiraz, Malbec drinker, then you might find this one leans a little bit towards the lighter side of your favoured style. But, you know, we're getting into spring lamb, I guess, and I think Pinot Noir is one of the absolute classic matches for spring lamb. It's quite delicate sweet meat, sweet fruit, bit of acidity to go through, that little bit of fattiness that you get. So it's a cracking match, and I think anybody who really likes Shiraz or Malbec or even the Cabernets, you know, sometimes it's nice to change things up and have something a little bit different, so give it a go.
Right, we will. Thanks very much, Sam.
No problem.
And thanks to Deng Young from Noel Young Wines for that. On to the food and drink news now. No university news, as they're on their Easter holiday. So, on to the city news.
Yes, and first, we'd like to say a big happy birthday to Hot Numbers in Gwydir Street, which is 5 years old this month. They've had their first ever blend of coffee too. It's called Body and Soul, which is aimed to deliver a well-balanced coffee with plenty of body, chocolate and nuts, all with a spiced fruit acidity.
And you could go and get some of that to polish off your lunch, because just down the road from Hot Numbers, in Calverley's Brewery in Hooper Street, you can go and get one of their beers and have a burger from Steak and Honour too. They'll be there till 3 o'clock today. From 6 till 9 tonight, the food at Calverley's will be provided by Frank Parnin of Le Gros Franc and La Maison du Steak on Hills Road.
Tomorrow and every Sunday at the Free Press in Prospect Row is the rock and roll chef, Barbara Fernandez, from 6 until 9 p.m.
The Pint Shop's new beer, Supersonic, which they've brewed in association with the Nene Valley Brewery in Oundle, is now on sale. And if that's not enough, they're hosting a tasting of aged Molinbeer beers from 6 till 8 p.m. this Wednesday. It includes four different ages of Blood Sweet and Trannin, Aged Hell and Verdomenis.
On the 9th of April, Sticky Beaks is popping up at Sticky Beaks in Hobson Street. They're doing food from 7:30 and it will be a delicious menu of some of their favourites. The price is £30 per head and a selection of wines and soft drinks will be on sale too. Book early via email info@stickybeakscafe.co.uk.
On the 14th of April, the Smoking Cow will be at the Cambridge Wine Merchants Bridge Street Wine Bar with pulled brisket, dirty dogs, bucket deals on craft beer and offers on bourbon and whiskey. No tickets necessary, just turn up.
And looking ahead to May, the celebrity chef lineup for 2016's Ely Food and Drink Festival has been announced. It will take place on the 1st and 2nd of May. It will feature Jean-Christophe Novelli, the award-winning French chef and Michelin star restaurateur. He simply loved being at the event last year, apparently, and is back by popular demand. And joining him, Jack Stein, son of Rick. He'll be relaying stories of restaurant life from Padstow and cooking up a fish dish. And the final chef on the books is local talent Ian Cumming, the Cambridge-based photographer and finalist from 2015's The Great British Bake Off. He'll be demonstrating his creative talents. There are a lot more events than that, and you can find details at visitely.org.uk.
And that's all we have time for today. Our next programme will be on the 2nd of April and will include the new brewer, Old Friends, new instrument shop come cafe, Leteo?
Luteo.
Luteo, thank you. And River Kitchen Pizza.
Coming up next on Cambridge 105 is the new music generator in session. Ethan Ash plays a live session recorded at Cambridge Regional College. From 2 till 3, it's Radio Dante. And from 3 till 5, 105 Sport.
At 5 o'clock, Tony Barnfield presents the magazine show Roundabout Cambridge, in which Hilary Ritchie, Adam Brooks' official archivist, tells Tony what's in store during the hospital's 250th anniversary. And Tony reports on the Cambridge rowers' preparations for next weekend's university boat race.
But that's all from Flavour for today. Don't forget, you can have a repeat dose tomorrow morning at 7 and from Cambridge 105 podcast page early next week. So, until the 2nd of April, from us all, goodbye.
Bye.